Page 9, Genesis chapter 10, beginning to read at verse 32. These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations. And from these, the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and sheltered there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth.
Thank you so much for reading for us, Peter, and may I add my warm welcome to you this Tuesday afternoon. I was speaking about today's passage to a friend on Sunday in the Sunday morning congregation here, and he sent me by email a transcript of this conversation, which took place reportedly on April the 10th, 1912, at Southampton Docks. "Good morning, ma'am. Welcome on board. May I take your luggage?" "You may, thank you." "So, this is the ship they say is unsinkable." "Yes, ma'am, that's correct. God himself could not sink this ship." Our subject this lunchtime is collective human pride. What does God make of the attempts by humanity to establish ourselves securely in his world, such that we make a name for ourselves? We speak of people overreaching themselves. Napoleon famously did it in his ambitions for Moscow, and the armies of the Third Reich repeated his folly. And I want us to see today that God will not allow us humans to make a name for ourselves in any lasting or meaningful way. That God stands behind the rise and fall of all empires and all human endeavors, and God particularly and deliberately scatters human pride. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I took the EasyJet flight to Riga in the Baltic in Latvia, and we were visiting some of the men and women who've been trained here at St. Helens for Christian work in that city. And as we drove in from the airport through the Pardogova region, means over the river, we could see the towers of old Riga looming in front of us. Medieval defensive towers, beautifully built from ancient Baltic brick. Cathedrals gloriously rising from the ground. And then a modern building off to one side, quite obviously built much more recently in the 20th century, designed deliberately to mimic the cathedrals. "What is that modern building?" "Oh, it's a science museum," said our host. "In Soviet times, the secular state determined to demonstrate that science had done for God, and so they built their science museums in the shape of cathedrals." Indeed, he said that in one Soviet city, there was a science museum built deliberately in the shape of a cathedral with a cross on top to drive the point home that human scientific achievement driven forward by the secularist ideology of the Soviet system had superseded God. Well, with hindsight, it seems God had other ideas. Indeed, people in the Baltic now speak of Soviet times only in the past tense. And I want us to see, therefore, this afternoon, that whilst many and various contributing factors may be blamed for the demise of human schemes, really there is one primary cause. God judges collective human arrogance. Just 2 points: human pride and God's judgment. Now, I say once again, I'm very conscious that this point is profoundly negative. I'm sorry about that. That's the way this part of the Bible is written. But unless we grasp this negative, we will spend our whole life seeking to create a legacy, to achieve lasting security, to realize our own significance. And we will cling on to the notion that we can do it without God. And God, in his kindness, wants us to realize that that will just be like pouring water into the sand, one vanity project after another, however impressive it looks. Let's begin then with human pride. And we find this in the opening verses of chapter 11 of Genesis. So if you turn back a page there, and particularly in verse 4. But before we go there, you'll notice that we omitted reading the whole of chapter 10. And the fourth main block of the book of Genesis begins in chapter 10, verse 1. These are the generations of the sons of Noah. We've identified that these are the generations of is like a section marker running through the chapters of Genesis. And so the fourth block begins there in verse 1. You will notice then that there's a long list of the sons of Noah and their offspring. Verse 2, the sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, Tiraz, the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Rippah, Togarmah, the sons of Javan, and so forth. Peter, who so expertly read chapter 11 for us, was originally due to read chapter 10, verses 1 through to 31. And when I sent the email saying, please, could you read, I got a one word back from him, phew, and that was it. So he breathed a sigh of relief. But by the end of chapter 10, verse 32, you will see that the sons of Noah have begun to achieve what Noah was commissioned to do in chapter 9. For Noah and his children, when they stepped into the virgin new world, were told by God, chapter 9, verse 1, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And again in chapter 9, verse 7, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth, multiply in it. And so chapter 10, verse 32, these are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. What then is to become of this fresh start in God's brand new world, washed as it has been from the wickedness of man? The answer comes in verses 1 to 4, and it's profoundly depressing. The whole earth had one language, chapter 11, verse 1, the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we dispersed over the face of the whole of the earth. Verse 4 has it for us, and you'll notice the arrogance, the pride, the hubris of humanity's collective desire. Come, let us build a city for ourselves and a tower with its top to the heavens. On the face of it, that doesn't look too bad, does it? Until you realize that in the book of Genesis, God's home is described as being in the heavens. And therefore, this appears to be another attempt by humanity to accomplish what humanity sought to achieve in Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve took of the fruit and ate of it in order to achieve divine status. They were taking hold of the throne of God. And it seems this tower has the same aim. And so immediately after Noah's son stepped from the ark of salvation, with the earth having been washed clean from human wickedness, we're told in chapter 9 that the heart of man is still evil all the time, and here we find in chapter 11 the pride of man as they gather together. We can do without God. We can reach to God. We can usurp God. We can take God's place. And therefore, this city of Babel and this Tower of Babel is a grand corporate project. And it stands for humanity operating in joint enterprise with no recognition of our Creator. Now, that reading of the first part of verse 4 is confirmed for us by the second part of verse 4. Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Now, you see, what began individually in Genesis chapter 3 with Adam and Eve in the old world has now taken root collectively with all of humanity gathering together as they move to populate the world, the new world. Apart from God, here is humankind seeking to establish its own identity, its own collective purpose, its own importance, its own legacy, apart from the Creator. In the Old Testament, God promises to make Abraham's name great, Genesis 12:2. In the Old Testament, God promises to make David's name great, 2 Samuel 7. And in the Old Testament, only God makes his own name great. And so for humanity to seek to create a lasting name, significance and self-importance for ourselves, apart from our Creator, is supreme arrogance when we pause and consider it. Imagine me coming to your firm. I'm a complete novice. Perhaps you're in insurance. I know nothing about insurance apart from how to make a good claim. An honest one, may I say, but a good claim. Imagine me coming. You instruct me in it. And then after 2 or 3 years in your firm, you discover there is me trying to usurp all your business and make a name for myself when you taught me absolutely everything I know. You'd have a right, I think, to express and experience outrage. And actually, you see that kind of outrage expressed in the business pages of the papers day after day when you see a boardroom coup and all the rest of it. Now, it is important, it seems to me, that we get clear at this point that it is arrogance and overreaching ambition that is the subject here. It's not human progress per se or human achievement. May I say, it would be all too easy for you to mishear what I'm saying, or indeed for somebody to misrepresent what I'm suggesting, or rather our author is saying, and therefore to suggest that all architectural or scientific or corporate or community or urban projects or cultural technological progress is wrong per se, and Christians are just anti any kind of progress. Yeah, you might hear it presented like that, but that's not the point. The point, rather, is that here is humanity seeking to usurp God's position and say, we can do it on our own without you, God, in your world. Move over. Perhaps the most, you'd say, almost ironic, comical part of this passage comes at the end of verse 4. So glance at the end of verse 4, because I find this remarkable. It's when it's considered alongside the grandiose scheme and the pretension of the first two lines of Genesis 11:4, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Do you see the insecurity of it? So alongside the arrogance, you've got this extraordinary insecurity. Oh yeah, we can walk our own way, God, move over, but hang on, we better hold on together in case we get dispersed over the whole earth. It makes one think of the small child determined to take early steps of independence away from mum and dad, yet acutely aware of the dangers lurking around the corner and then coming scurrying back every 2 minutes. One of the best commentators on Genesis is still, I think, written, I've mentioned it before, written in the 1960s, Derek Kidner. The elements of the story are timelessly characteristic of the spirit of the world. The project is typically grandiose. Men describe it excitedly to one another as if it were the ultimate achievement, very much as modern man glories in his space projects. You might say people in the city glory at their business or whatever it happens to be. And at the same time, they betray their insecurity as they crowd together to preserve their identity and control their fortunes. Now, once we've done this close study of verse 4, as is always the way when we look at the Bible carefully, we find it absolutely everywhere. You don't need a PhD in cultural analysis to be able to see this absolutely everywhere. So the name given to the place where this tower is built is Babel. This is clearly a comment on Babylon. And from this point on, Babylon in the Bible becomes the synonym for all human pride and arrogance. I went online this week and listened to a lecture delivered at the New York Metropolitan by Dr. John Curtis, keeper of the Middle Eastern collection in the British Museum. I have to say, it was not the most riveting lecture, and I only got halfway through, but the original ancient Babylon was not only one of the seven wonders of the world with its hanging gardens, it also depicted itself as the centre of the universe. And he held up one of the stone cuneiform, and there was Babylon, centre of the universe, overreaching pride. And then in modern Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar from the 6th century BC had every brick of the city stamped with his name stamped on it. King Nebuchadnezzar, I built it. Overreaching pride. But not simply when you study the old world. Of course, this week has been dominated by the whole European issue. And I usually try and read Matthew Paris because he's one of the leading secularists in our culture. And so I think it's quite helpful to know how they're arguing and what they're thinking. He was fascinating, his talk about the potential of a Brexit. And I thought, this has got Genesis 11 written all over it. Listen to what he said. What would our storming out of the West's most important concert of nations do for the West? A great wound would be inflicted to the clout that the continent of Europe carries, to the self-belief of European civilization, and to the image of Europe in the world. It would carry profound implications for more than the balance of power in the world, but for the battle of ideas and values too, a battle which is turning critical and for which the century ahead looks ever more likely to form the stage. Do you see? Overweening arrogance, the West is best. Terrified insecurity, fear, Genesis 11. Indeed, I reread as part of my preparation Tony Blair's original speech outlining the foreign policy of New Labour back in 1999. You may remember, gave the speech in Chicago first and then before the United States Congress in 2003. He argued for, quote, an international community based on core shared values prepared actively to intervene and resolve problems as an essential precondition of our future prosperity and stability. And he set the debate in terms of battle between progress and reaction. Those, you can hear him speaking, can't you? Those who embrace opportunity in the modern world and those who reject it. And he polarized the positions between optimism and hope and pessimism and fear. And he argued for active engagement in order to advance democracy, for a broad global alliance towards that end, a kind of imperialistic democracy. And where did it come to? And then where you see that position put forward by the person who famously did not do God, Genesis 11 is absolutely alive and kicking. Fear, insecurity, arrogance, pride. We want to make a name for ourselves. We want a legacy. We want some security and longevity and significance and substance. At the same time, we're wrought through with fear and insecurity in this tough world in which we live. And for so long as we say to God, I'm going to do it on my own without you, God has a response. And the response is there in verses 5 to 9. Divine judgment. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they're one people, they have one language. This is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the whole of the face of the earth. And they left off building the city. So the Tower of Babel stood rather like the pinnacle did, limply there, as a testament to human pride and folly. Now, the material here in verses 5 to 9, in fact, the whole piece, is beautifully crafted. And verse 5 underlines the futility of the human project. Do you see verse 5? The Lord came down to see. I know it's suggesting sort of a characteristics of humanity for God, but it's deliberately put like that, as if to say, oh, this great shard that Babylonians have built, this vast metropolis which appears to be so immovable, God is saying, now where is it? Let me get my telescope. Anybody got it there? My observatory. I really can't quite see it down there. Perhaps I better go down and take a closer look. Do you see? Humanity. What have we achieved? God, where is this thing they're talking about? We puff out our chests. We boast of human achievement. A scientist discovers how to split the atom. A chemist or physicist unearths some new source of power. An artist puts the finishing touch to some great cultural masterpiece. An architect constructs a cheese grater. And the God who made the universe, who has divine copyright on all art, all scientific achievement, looks at it and says, well, I never, they've learnt how to put the triangular shape in the triangular hole. Well done. Now, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but the more I read what the Hebrew scholars say, which I've been trying to do, about these lines, the more it seems to me a little bit like an ancient equivalent of a rap. So the letters of the name Babylon appear everywhere in the original text, so that it almost sounds like Babylon, apparently, as it's being read. And then did you notice verse 3, come, literally, go to, verse 4, come, literally, go to, verse 7, God mimics man, come, let us go down. So man says, let us build for ourselves. The word is nabela. God says, let us confuse. The word is nilbenar. Man says, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed. God says, I will disperse them. From there the Lord dispersed them. So God acts in judgment over humanity, and God deliberately confuses our language so that we cannot cooperate on an international level in order to establish an eternal and universal name for ourselves. Ask, is somebody sitting out here today or listening online or whatever, that's pretty kind of mean of God. I wonder if you felt that as we were looking at verse 6. Behold, they are one people, they have one language, nothing will now be impossible. Well, you could look at it as mean, but you could say to yourself, given the wickedness of man and the evil of our human heart, God's act of dispersing us is in reality an act of tremendous merciful kindness. Imagine what evil might be achieved by humanity if the arrogant pride of Babylon could be established over the whole of the earth eternally. Think of some of the secularist superstates of the 20th century if they had been able to take hold of the whole of Europe. Imagine what it would have been like. I think we're ready then to apply. What does God have to say to the human race as we say to ourselves, come, let's make a name for ourselves? What does God have to say to the human race as we say to ourselves, oh, we don't do God, we're going to make a global village? What does God have to say to the human race as we say to ourselves, let's protect our human frailty and insecurity by clubbing together to create X, Y, or Z without God? As you drive from the airport towards the city of old Riga, you can see a science museum constructed deliberately after the fashion of a cathedral. In one former Soviet city, the equivalent building has a cross on it. The message is plain. We don't do God. Science has superseded God. Who brought down the Soviet state in your thinking? Ancient Babylon. I'm told by Professor Curtis that ancient Babylon depicted itself as being at the heart of the globe. Professor Curtis also reliably informs us that it cannot be excavated because the river Euphrates changed course and it now lies underwater. Who brought down ancient Babylon? Modern Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, from the 6th century BC, was excavated by the German archaeologist Robert Koldewey, and you will find much of it in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, and what isn't in the Pergamon Museum rests safely under the care of Dr. Curtis in the British Museum. Who brought down modern Babylon, I wonder, in your thinking? New Labour that didn't do God. Who confused New Labour such that they couldn't understand one another's speech, I wonder? The progressive, you see, may not do God, but God does not do human pride. And he wonderfully and mercifully and kindly limits human ability to cooperate in vast man-made projects. He brings down the mighty from their thrones. He deposes those who are proud in the imagination of their hearts. Does this not have huge implications for the pretensions of any superstate, any global business, any superpower, any global village, or any secularist state seeking to establish itself without reference to God? Could it be more relevant to the debates and discussions in our newspapers this morning? Remember, God is not anti-human. Human progress, God is anti-human pride. And as we start to say, no, we're going to shove over God, move over, then God will bring us to nothing. Does it not also have big implications for you and me and what we are going to devote ourselves to if we want to leave a legacy? One of the interesting things when you get to my age, I'm now in my 50s, I know you may not believe it. Somebody said to me the other day, I look at you and I think I've done rather well. He was 60. and he then said, you've clearly been working a lot harder than me, William, which I thought was a little harsh, but there we go. Anyway, I noticed that people, when they get to my stage, start talking about leaving a legacy. Isn't it interesting? And people, when they start in the city, start talking about fulfilling their potential. Isn't it good of God to tell us up front in the Bible that we will never leave a legacy of any value, of any use, of any lasting significance if we try to do it apart from him? Doesn't that stop you pouring your energies into the sand? Isn't it rather wonderful and kind of him? So where should I pour my energies? Well, you'll have to come back next week to hear. But just have a look at chapter 12, verse 2, would you? Because next week we turn the corner. Chapter 12, verse 2. Verse 1, the Lord said to Abraham. Verse 2, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You'll only achieve anything of lasting value if you line up with everything that Abraham stands for. And everything that Abraham stands for is fulfilled in and through Jesus. Come back next week, and that's what we're going to be talking about. Let's pray together. Father, we see the acute relevance of this, and we feel it personally. Whether churchmen like me or those who are involved in the business of this world, we feel it. Forgive us for attempting to make a name for ourselves apart from you. Please, would you humble us? And please would you keep us acutely dependent upon you and aware of our own feebleness and frailty. And please would you open our eyes to see Jesus and the great name that you have made for him and in him. And we ask it in his name. Amen.